In this lecture, I'll be talking to you about insect silks. They're quite diverse structures and have many different functions in insects. Okay, first of all, our aim is to know the structure and origin of insect silks, the origin meaning what type of glands they come from. We have to look at the biological uses of silks, they're very diverse, and the structure and function of the silk production system in Lepidopteran larvae. We'll focus on that because Lepidopteran silks have so many commercial purposes, and they're also very important for the survival of caterpillars and their pest status and economic status. Okay, so first of all, we have to pose this question: what is a silk? It turns out that there are many different gland systems that produce what we call silks. So they're not really homologous. That is, they're regarded as homologous if they're all made by the same gland, but they're not. So it looks like there's been many independent evolutions of silks. So in a review article that myself and colleagues published a couple of years ago in Annual Review of Entomology, we defined silk this way. It's a functional term, so it doesn't indicate evolutionary relationships. It's functional. It describes protein fibers that are spun within arthropod lineages. So arthropods doesn't just include insects, it can include spiders as well. Their use of silk is famous. So the word spinning can be misleading because spinning doesn't necessarily involve rotation or twisting of the fiber. But in fact, it refers to this process of making an insoluble filament from an aqueous protein solution. So the silk, as it is secreted by the insect, is liquid, and the insect does something to it. It stretches it as it leaves the insect's body, and that turns it into an insoluble filament by changing the structure of the proteins within the silk, aligning those protein fibers and rendering them insoluble. So that's the important thing. They've gone from a soluble protein solution to an insoluble filament. Obviously, spider and insect silks aren't dissolved by rainfall. Okay, so one of the points of this lecture is that silks have evolved independently many times. So the diagram that we're looking at here has at the bottom a possible phylogeny of the insects. On the right-hand side, we have the holometabolous insects that have a pupal stage. On the left-hand side, the hemimetabolous insects. So let's look at the different types of silks. The L here stands for labial silks. So these are groups of insects that employ labial silks. Labial silks are derived from the salivary glands. All insects have labial glands or salivary glands. Labial gland is a little bit more specific term. And they use saliva for obvious functions, similar to invertebrates like us. It's lubrication of the food and also producing enzymes that initiate the breakdown of food. So that's the most common usage of saliva or labial gland secretions right across the insects. But in some insects, the labial glands are producing a silk rather than saliva with the lubricant and enzymatic activity. So let's have a look on the right-hand side. Butterflies and moths, well, they're very well known for their production of silk, but it's not the adults, it's the larval stage, the caterpillars. In the Diptera, there are three different groups that are known to produce silks. Glowworms and blackflies produce labial silks, but the dance flies sitting above them, they produce silk from a different type of gland that we talked about in an earlier mini lecture. Fleas, wasps, sawflies, book lice, and even crickets produce labial silks. So the fact that the crickets and the book lice are in the hemimetabola and they're not closely related to each other, whereas the other groups using labial silks, once again, they're independent origins, as they don't fit into one category or one clade in this phylogenetic tree. So that tells us that the use of silks as the use of labial gland secretions to produce silks has evolved independently multiple times. And we would expect, if we were looking at the structure of the silks, to see that they might have different molecular structures for example, in the crickets versus the Lepidoptera, the butterflies and moths, because they're not that closely related. They evolved independently, this origin of silk from the labial gland, so we would expect the silks to be quite different, and in fact they usually are. Okay, so these are labial silks superimposed on the phylogeny. Let's look at another type of silk, the colloterial gland silks. The colloterial glands are glands associated with the female reproductive system. Now, in most insects, these secretions have a diversity of functions, but the primary function is as a glue, to glue the eggs together or to glue the eggs to a substrate. But you can see that there are two examples here, water beetles and lacewings, where the colloterial gland secretion is actually used to make a silk. In the case of lacewings, you can see that the eggs themselves are deposited at the end of a stalk. A higher resolution image of this is provided on the web. So what the insects do is they secrete the colloterial gland substance and then pull their abdomen, touch it on the substrate, pull their abdomen away from the substrate, and in so doing, they stretch this fibrous protein and then it hardens immediately and then they deposit the egg on top of it. So it suspends the eggs from the substrate, making them less liable to be predated upon by something crawling over a leaf, for example. So the lacewings, the Neuroptera, there are some very nice videos available on YouTube. An Attenborough, I think it was Life in the Undergrowth, had some very good video of that. I can't use that. Okay, so we've looked at labial gland silks, we've looked at colloterial gland silks, and they're very different to each other, but they still come under this category of silk as we defined it earlier. Another type of silks are those that are produced by the class 3 dermal glands. If we look at the right-hand side, the dance flies, the Empedidae, it looks like that the structures that are producing silks there are derived from sense organs. We talked about that earlier. There are other groups that use class 3 dermal glands, the web spinners over on the left-hand side, bristletails and silverfish use them in association with mating. The web spinners are an interesting example. They're characterized by very swollen tarsi that produce silk, and the colony lies underneath a silk gallery. They spend an extraordinary amount of time spinning silk. And the glands that produce the silk there are in the tarsi, so they might also be derived from a sensory structure, but that's not certain. There have been a couple of ultrastructural studies done of the web spinner silks, and it's a little inconclusive, but they do appear to be class 3 dermal glands, but whether they're an independent origin or whether they're derived from a sense organ, we don't know. And actually, an ex-student who's done this course is living in Townsville, is on Magnetic Island, and in the region of Townsville, there are some very big colonies of web spinners, and we're proposing to have a look at the structure of those glands just to see if we can tell a little bit more about where they're derived from. Another type of silk is produced in Malpighian tubules. If you go to that section, that module associated with excretion, you'll see that the Malpighian tubules right across the insects are like the kidneys of insects. They produce excretions, and they're blind tubes that open at the junction of the hindgut and the midgut. But once again, in just a few insects, the Malpighian tubules have changed their function, and they produce a secretion that travels from the Malpighian tubule along the hindgut to the anus, where it's excreted and drawn away from the surface and produces a silk. So that's seen in some lacewings, some plant-eating beetles, and in mayflies. So that's quite a novel function of Malpighian tubules. Structurally and at the microscopic level, not much is known about how they do this. Many of the studies are quite old and haven't used modern technologies such as confocal microscopy, etc., to examine the production of those Malpighian tubule silks. But the point here is now we've seen multiple different organs that are producing silks. That tells us that all silks aren't homologous. There have been many independent origins of silks. Okay, now we'll focus more detail on the silks of Lepidoptera. The famous silk, the silk that we use for clothing, for shirts, comes from the silkworm. Now, the silk that they produce, that's used commercially, is actually what the caterpillar uses to make the pupal case, the cocoon. So the larvae are actually, while they're feeding on mulberry leaves, they do leave silk trails, but it's not a big enough volume for humans to make use of it. But when they're spinning their cocoon, they just undergo this very repeated stereotype pattern where they twist their head in circles backwards and forwards, and they make this thick layer of silk. And I don't know if you've ever seen this, but I'll describe it. The way to extract that silk for human use is to take a cocoon, dip it into some warm water to remove some of the glues from the silks, the outer layer of the silk, and then pick up one silk fiber and then start spinning on a stick or a loom of some description, and the cocoon spins away on the warm water surface, and a single line of silk can be spun off. So I'm not sure of the length, but it would be hundreds of meters of silk can be spun off from a single cocoon. That's done on a commercial scale now. So insect silks can be used for many commercial products. But one of the points I want to make here is that it's not just used in making cocoons. Most Lepidopteran larvae lay a silk trail wherever they go. It's just that it's not really concentrated, so we can't see it all the time. And the fact that they utilize silk so much maybe makes them vulnerable if we wanted to look at pest control, if we could manipulate the way they use silk. So it's worth knowing how pest insects use things, unusual structures such as silks. This scanning electron micrograph here is the head of a caterpillar of Helicoverpa armigera. It's a major pest throughout the world. You would have seen it on tomatoes. It's very common on cotton, on corn, quite a number of crops. So the larvae eat away at the fruiting bodies, and that's why there's such a pest. The electron micrograph you can see in the head region, just underneath the some of the sensory structures on the head, there's a spigot with a line of silk running away from it. These micrographs were taken by Bronwyn Cribb in a project that we were working on a few years ago. If we zoom in, you can see the spigot in a little bit more detail here. Those circular structures on the side of the head are the larval stemmata or the eyes, and you can see the silk is running down the length of the body there, and the silk is exuded from the tip of this specialized structure called a spigot. It's got a flared opening at one end. When you put the silk fibers underneath the electron microscope, you can see that they're composed of two parallel strands. You can see that in this image here. The silk is actually made of two proteins, a fibrin and a sericin, and one of them is soluble, that's removed under water, but the remainder of the silk stays quite strong even after it has been soaked in water. Now, this electron micrograph on the right-hand side shows silk fibers on a plant surface, a leaf, after a caterpillar has been walking over that leaf. And the silk fibers have been wrapped around the trichomes, which are these pointed structures on the surface of leaves. Nearly all leaves have them, and it's telling us that the caterpillar is gaining, is holding its place on that plant by wrapping silk around the trichomes on the plant. The microstructures are not even visible to our naked eye. And that means that you might have seen this behavior. If you disturb a caterpillar on a leaf, it drops off the leaf, but it stays suspended on the silk fiber. So it shows the incredible strength of these very, very thin fibers. The caterpillar will then crawl back up that silk fiber to get back onto the plant after the danger is gone. On the left-hand side, you can see a silk fiber that has been stained with a fluorescent stain, which is relevant in a moment in the next slide. A little further on. But what I'll do now is just look at the structure of the salivary glands of Helicoverpa once again. You could say it's quite similar to the silk moth as well. The silk moth has more differentiation along the silk gland because they utilize such massive quantities when they're making the cocoon. But on the bottom right-hand side, or let's look at the bottom left-hand side, you can see that sort of sinuous structure inside the larger structure, well, that's the lumen where the silk is stored as a fluid. There are very large cells around that lumen. If we look at the top layer, there's a couple of transmission electron micrographs of those cells. And the main characteristic you can see is they are very hairy appearing, and that's because those tiny processes called microvilli, they produce a huge surface area of the cell membrane, allowing the secretion to pass through that cell membrane. They have a nucleus that's visible in those micrographs, and then the bottom right-hand side, the blue stain, is a nuclear stain applied to a gland. And you can see that the nucleus is very highly branched within each cell. That's unusual because mostly nuclei are quite circular, but it shows that there's something related to the function of these secreting cells that means that the nucleus is quite large and quite branched. Obviously, the branching increases the surface area, but exactly what for, we don't know. The internal structures inside the head of a caterpillar are quite complex as well. A student did a lot of light microscopy cutting sections and reconstructing the silk press inside the head of a caterpillar. If you look at the left-hand side, there's two yellow tubes. They're the two independent left and right sides of the salivary gland lumen. They join together and they come out at the spigot in a common lumen. But the coloured blocks there are all the different types of muscles that regulate the pressure on that silk through a cuticular structure. So the silk, after the labial glands join together, then there's a cuticular silk press. And that silk press has a lot of muscles attached to it, and the insect can contract and relax those muscles to control the rate of release of secretion, and that links to their behavior as they're pulling their head away from the substrate. They're probably regulating muscle activity to release or restrict the amount of secretion being produced. The take-home message here is that there's a complex silk press with a lot of musculature that is associated with releasing silk. Silk trails, we use that fluorescent stain that I showed you earlier to allow, first of all, we videoed a caterpillar moving across a surface. Then we removed that caterpillar and stained the surface it had been across with the fluorescent stain. And that's what's shown on the far right-hand side there. The image has been inverted to make the silk, the real silk that's left behind, is the continuous black line. So on the left-hand side is an accumulating image of a larva. This is the first instar larva of Helica verpa. It's probably only about a millimeter long. The head is the dark end. And you can see that as it moves on this sort of U-shaped path, that the head is veering off the trail quite frequently. And in the middle image, the blue dots indicate the centroid of the body, the center of the main body, whereas the red dots indicate where the head was at each of these frames of this video. And you can see that the head diverts a lot from the direction of movement. So the head is moving backwards and forwards, and what it's probably doing, as we can tell from looking at the silk trail that it produces, is actually dotting silk to the left and right of where it's going. You can see one little area where there's a massive figure eight of silk, and that was associated with the larva slowing down and showing a figure of eight movement of the head. So it seems as if at irregular intervals they just lay down a mat of silk that might be the anchoring if in just in case they are forced off the leaf. Okay, other insects produce labial silks and use them in very different ways. Glowworms are an example that I'm quite familiar with. They produce a labial silk, but it's used to trap prey just in the same way that spiders use silk to make prey, and that's where they get the genus name Arachnocamper. It means it's spider-like grub. So you can see there's a horizontal line there. That's a mucus tube or runway. And the animal, there's a video on the website to show you this. The animal lies along that runway and dips its head down and regurgitates a drop of mucus and then pulls the head back and releases silk. So all the drops are sitting on a continuous line of silk. So the animal makes this thing called a snare or a web, and it's designed to trap flying insects that are attracted by the larva's glow. and they fly into this web and they're stuck in the mucus, and the larva will just hang down, pull it up and start eating on it. So that's quite a different use of silk in glowworms. I've already talked to you about the Empididae, the dance flies, where the silk there is used by males originally with the evolutionary origin is to wrap a prey item that the male has caught and to offer that as what's called a nuptial gift to the female. But further down the line, the males get clever, well, evolution is clever, I guess, and they create a balloon that has nothing inside it, but that's become part of the mating ritual, and it doesn't really matter to the female that the male hasn't got any prey wrapped in that silk, but it's part of the ritual associated with getting to the point of copulation and fertilization. So that's quite another, that's a very different use of silk, and you wouldn't expect that silk to be structurally useful. This electron micrograph shows the spinnerets of a spider. This has been pseudo-coloured, and the purpley pink colour there is the silk being exuded from these structures called spinnerets. One of the reasons that we've sort of produced this lecture on silks is because of the potential value of silks as biomimetic materials. My co-author on that review in the Annual Review of Entomology is a CSIRO researcher who set out to sequence silks from a huge diversity of insects and spiders to see if there were common structures in the protein of the silks and to see if they could make biological copies or biomimetics of silks. You may have heard of the potential of silks because of their incredible strength in relation to their very small cross-section. And military applications, you might have heard of this possibility of using silks in bulletproof jackets to hold up a bullet because their strength is incredible in relation to their size. And my colleague at CSIRO is in the process of making copies of silks and being able to produce them into sheets, and they have some unusual properties. It's a long-term exploration, but there may be big potential in trying to copy what nature has already produced through a long process of evolution.